This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Christopher Dickey, Newsweek's Middle East Regional Editor and Paris Bureau Chief. In this week's edition, he co-wrote the story Ripples of War, about how the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah is resonating beyond the battlefield and why the conflagrations in Gaza, Lebanon, and Iraq risk converging. We recorded our interview this morning. Dickey was in a studio in Paris. I asked him first about the Israeli bombing of the Lebanese town Qana, the most deadly single episode so far during this war. A couple of extended families had taken shelter in a house that was struck by an Israeli missile. The majority of the people killed were children. Israel subsequently declared a 48-hour cessation of airstrikes, with the exception of strikes in support of its ground forces or strikes that could stop an imminent attack on Israelis. Christopher Dickey, welcome back to Fresh Air. What do you think Qana means as a turning point in this war?
I'm not sure it will be the kind of turning point in this war that it was in 1996, 10 years ago, during the Grapes of Wrath offensive, when there was another massacre at Qana and more than 100 people were killed by Israeli shelling. At that point, the United States was already engaged trying to arrange a ceasefire and had been almost from the start. And all of a sudden, it galvanized public and world opinion. And basically, the government of Israel at that point decided it had to step back. We're not seeing that happen this time, although there is as much or more rage in the Arab and Muslim world about this incident. And although the fighting has gone on longer now than it had in 1996, the United States still doesn't seem to have the political will or perhaps the ability to step in and say to the Israelis, you have got to stop now. We've got a 48-hour temporary humanitarian pause. But the policy still seems to be support Israel in trying to wipe out Hezbollah somehow on the ground. And that means the war is probably going to go on.
But Condoleezza Rice has been saying she thinks that a ceasefire could be negotiated by the end of the week.
By the end of the week, yeah. Many days from now in a war like this. And probably it won't happen by the end of the week. There's too many things at play. Basically, Israel has backed itself into a terrible corner with this war. To some extent, it's been manipulated by Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah. Once it decided to engage in this major way and go from sort of skirmishing along the border or small punitive attacks as a result of Hezbollah strikes and the Hezbollah kidnapping of the soldiers, and to open up the whole theater of real war, now it has to win it. But how does it win it? It has to wipe out Hezbollah? No, it can't do that. So it has to kill Nasrallah? Well, I think we're going to see a major effort to do exactly that, with the risk of many, many more civilian casualties in the near future, because that's what happens when you try to use bombs to blow away individual persons. But Israel needs to get some kind of victory out of this. So basically what we see is Israel is stalling and the United States continues to run interference for it in hopes that it can somehow pull some kind of face-saving victory out of the situation. But for right now, any kind of ceasefire would basically play to Hezbollah's benefit. It would come out the victor in this, and arguably it already has.
And when you say victor, what do you mean?
Well, it's a guerrilla force. It's not a very big force. It's 3,000-4,000 fighters. It has, yes, maybe it has 13,000 rockets and missiles. Most of them are very short range. The damage that it has actually inflicted on Israel has been relatively small. Of more than 50 Israelis who have been killed, the vast majority have been soldiers, in fact, killed in combat. What Hezbollah is showing, however, is that it can stand up against what had previously been regarded as the military superpower of the region. And when a guerrilla force is able to do that and survive, then that's counted as a victory in most of the guerrilla warfare that has ever taken place. And that's exactly what's happening now.
You're saying that Israel was previously regarded as the military superpower in the region. So I'm wondering if you think once this particular war ends, if you think Israel will be more vulnerable to attack because it looks more vulnerable than it did before the war started.
Absolutely. That is the fear in Israel, and it is a growing fear in a lot of segments of the Israeli government and society. If Israel has a major loss of face, a major loss of prestige, a loss of awe, if you will, as a result of this engagement, then it will be more vulnerable. There's a proverb that was quoted to us last week by the well-known Israeli historian Amatzia Baram, which is that when a tree is bent, the goats jump over it. Israel could well be bent by this engagement, and the feeling is that the goats, the invaders, the people who hate Israel will take advantage of this situation, take advantage of its loss of prestige, the loss of awe, and just come after it again and again and again. And I think the loss of deterrence is what the Israeli political establishment and military establishment fear the most right now. And that deterrence has been very, very badly battered by the performance of Hezbollah over the last couple of weeks.
Do you think Israel is fighting for its existence right now?
There are many Israelis who are starting to feel that way, who are looking at this two-front war, where, in fact, the firepower is all on Israel's side, but the firepower isn't making the enemies go away. It's not making them stop fighting. Remember that this is the same nation that managed to conquer every Arab army against it, Jordan, Syria, and most importantly, Egypt, in 6 days in 1967. Now, this war has gone on more than three times that long, and Israel has not managed to eliminate a force of 3,000 to 4,000 men. That is not good for Israel's image. It's not good, a lot of Israelis believe, for its survival over the long run.
You write in Newsweek, something less than victory for Israel and something less than defeat for Hezbollah may be the only formula that can bring the fighting to a stop. Can you explain what you mean there?
Well, we're looking at what appears to be more and more of a stalemate. Israel is not succeeding in eliminating Hezbollah. We don't really know to the extent to which it has degraded Hezbollah's ability to launch rockets into Israel. Hezbollah continues launching rockets into Israel. It hasn't been able to eliminate the Hezbollah leadership. It has not been able to achieve its objectives. If it continues to be unable to achieve those objectives, and the violence continues, and the civilians continue to die in Lebanon by the hundreds, and international opinion continues to turn ever more sharply against Israel, then for obvious reasons, Israel is going to want to see some kind of end to the fighting in which it can pull back and maybe leave Hezbollah in existence, but at least circumscribe its ability to rearm. All of this would be a compromise. It would be something of a compromise on Hezbollah's part, although they would certainly claim victory, and it would necessitate serious compromise on Israel's part. So that's what we're talking about, something that is literally less than victory for Israel and less than defeat for Hezbollah. Remember, when Israel started this campaign, its objectives were complete defeat for Hezbollah.
What do you think is most likely to happen in terms of a settlement?
I think that we're going to see a lot of talking at the UN, and you're going to see more and more international pressure. Already, even Prime Minister Tony Blair of Great Britain is having trouble supporting American policy on this. There are indications that Condoleezza Rice may be getting more and more uncomfortable with the isolation that the Americans are feeling. Remember that she's been trying to build international consensus, especially about the Middle East and about a whole range of problems for the last year and a half and two years, and she's been quite successful. Now all of that is sort of crumbling through her fingers as a result of this war. So she's going to want to push for a diplomatic solution. But it isn't clear that the White House is on board with this. The White House, President Bush, his advisors like Elliot Abrams, definitely want to see something very positive, a major blow in the war on terror struck here in Lebanon. And, you know, I'm sure they hope that's what's going to happen. It just doesn't look like what is going to happen. So we're going to have this muddled situation for the next several days, possibly weeks, in which more people die, more talk goes on about establishing a ceasefire, but the actual thing the cessation of hostilities is very, very slow in coming.
Israel has said about its bombing campaign, including the bombing of Khanna, that Hezbollah integrates its weapons and its fighters within neighborhoods in Lebanon, using civilians as human shields. So in order to attack Hezbollah, you have to attack neighborhoods, and if people remain in their neighborhoods, they're going to be at risk. What do you know about how integrated Hezbollah is within neighborhoods of Lebanon?
Hezbollah is very well integrated in the neighborhoods of and the villages of South Lebanon. There's no question about that. They run schools. They run clinics. They run basically the whole social services network down there, in addition to being a fighting force. They have done a lot of work over the years, not only the 6 years since Israel withdrew from South Lebanon, but in the 24 years that they've been in existence to build political and popular and social support. They are a very intelligent organization that way, not only as a guerrilla organization, but as a political party. So are they integrated down there? Absolutely they are. But that being said, Israel knows that it's going to have to attack villages, it's going to have to attack all kinds of locations, apartment blocks, where Hezbollah might be. And it needs to be very careful that it hits the right people in that process. This is not just a moral question. It's very much a political question for Israel. Do they want to win this war? Well, if they want to win the war, they cannot carry out attacks that take the lives of 30 or 40 children in one incident. That's disastrous from Israel's point of view. And to do so in Khanna, where there's an infamous massacre remembered by everybody in the Arab world and the Middle East, to do that there 10 years later, again, speaks to a kind of a political misjudgment that bodes very, very, very badly for the future of this war from the Israeli point of view.
How do you think al-Qaeda is trying to turn this conflict to its advantage?
Al-Qaeda has found itself oddly marginalized in this. Remember that the representative of al-Qaeda in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was killed a few weeks ago, was the great promoter of sectarian war against the Shiites. And Hezbollah is a Shiite organization. It's very interesting that Ayman al-Zawahiri, the ideologue of al-Qaeda, the number two of Osama bin Laden, came out a few days ago on television with one of those videotapes, although this one produced in what seemed like a very slick television studio, saying, no, all Muslims should stand together and we should back Lebanon. He didn't say we should back Hezbollah, but that was the clear implication. And as a result, you've basically got al-Qaeda deciding to ride the wave that's being generated by Hezbollah of public sentiment in this battle against Israel.
What about the Palestinians? Hamas and Hezbollah had been, I think, in a way, rival groups, and Hamas is Sunni, Hezbollah is Shiite. Has this war changed their relationship?
That relationship has been evolving over a long period of time. The first extended contacts between Hamas and Hezbollah took place in 1992, when Israel exiled hundreds of Hamas leaders to South Lebanon, and they wound up literally in the hands of Hezbollah. They started talking. They had lots of differences, ideological differences. And then Iran got on board, took advantage of this situation, started to train some Hamas operatives. And you've had extensive contacts ever since. What's happened recently is that that's all become much more public, much more overt. And you've got a situation now in Gaza, which is still besieged and has been since the end of June. After an Israeli soldier was kidnapped there, you've got a situation in Gaza where people are singing a popular song that goes right on Hezbollah. They're flying Hezbollah flags, and they clearly wish they could emulate the kind of resistance that Hezbollah is showing in South Lebanon, which is not a good thing for peace in the near future.
Do you think that Hamas and Hezbollah are coordinating their response to Israel and their attacks on Israel in any way?
Circumstantially, it would appear that they are. The kidnapping of an Israeli corporal by Hamas on June 25th was an operation that was in many ways very similar to the kidnapping of two Israeli soldiers by Hezbollah on the northern border on July 12th. And Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, has been explicit, saying that the kidnapping operation that he performed was one that was conducted in support of the Palestinians in Gaza. See, what Hezbollah wants to do and what Iran, which basically created and entirely subsidizes Hezbollah, wants to do is take over this tremendously potent issue of Palestinian resistance to Israel. But there are no Shia Palestinians to speak of. So basically they need to do this by allying with the Palestinians and by allying with Hamas. Iran is trying to send money, large amounts of money, to Hamas or to the Hamas-led government in Gaza. And at the same time, you've got Hezbollah playing this this military and guerrilla game, training and aiding and abetting Hamas. So, yes, I think there's a certain extensive level of cooperation.
Why does Hezbollah want to take over the Palestinian cause? And related to that, what do you think their larger goals are? What do they finally want?
Well, I think they want to take over the Palestinian cause because it remains the great symbol of oppression and injustice that exists in the Arab and Muslim world. Now, what are Hezbollah's ambitions? Hezbollah's ambitions are very much Iran's ambitions at this point. Hezbollah used to be seen as a national movement in Lebanon resisting occupation. That's the way it was portrayed by the Lebanese. That's one of the reasons its political power became so extensive in Lebanon. But in fact, it was created, it is funded, it is trained by Iran, and it is serving Iran's national interests. And what does Iran want? Iran wants to be the preeminent regional power in the Middle East, and it wants to be treated as such by the United States and every other country in the world. Hezbollah is an agent of that policy.
So in a way, do you think what Iran wants here is like, you've got to talk with us, you've got to deal with us?
Absolutely. And that's exactly what the Syrians want, too. The Syrians, who are allies and now basically acolytes of the Iranians, want to be taken seriously. The United States has done its best to isolate Iran, mainly because of the nuclear issue, but also for lots of ideological and historical reasons. And it has treated Syria as if it were a country that could be marginalized and excluded. This is Syria's ticket out of that isolation, or at least that's what it wants it to be. And, of course, that's exactly what Israel wants to prevent, which is why it's unlikely we're going to see a real ceasefire anytime in the near future.
Well, because you think there can't really be a ceasefire unless Iran and Syria are part of the deal and the United States refuses to talk with them. Still.
That's right. Mm-hmm. There, and the United States – but you see, this is the trap that the United States has gotten into and to some extent Israel has gotten into. You have a situation where for more than a year, the United States has done its best and France has done its best and the European Union has done its best to marginalize and isolate Syria so that some kind of democracy movement can take hold in Lebanon. Remember the Lebanese Spring, the Arab Spring, the Democratic Spring of last year? All of that is crumbling because why? Basically, Syria is saying you can't play in this region without us, and the Americans are beginning to conclude that that might just be true and that they are going to have to invite Syria back into Lebanon in some way, and they really don't want to do that. So what is the United States doing? It's supporting Israel in its attempt to use military means to transform the situation on the ground, to change the facts on the ground in Lebanon, where Hezbollah and Syrian power are concerned. Unfortunately, that hasn't been working.
What do you mean when you say the United States might have to invite Syria back into Lebanon?
Well, very early on in the crisis, you heard Condoleezza Rice saying, you know, the Syrians know that they have responsibilities and duties in Lebanon. Now, she spoke that as if it were a threat to the Syrians, but the Syrians were, great, this is terrific. You're telling us we have responsibilities in Lebanon? Let's talk about what the price is for us to exercise those responsibilities. The only time that Hezbollah was ever seriously held in check after its creation was in the late 80s and early 90s when Syria moved in and occupied the whole of the country of Lebanon. At that point, if Hezbollah got out of line, the Syrians would line Hezbollahis up and shoot them. I'm not sure that Syria even has the power to do that anymore, but back then, the world was happy to have Hafez al-Assad doing it. Now, there are many people who would wish that to end this crisis, they could get Bashar al-Assad, the son of Hafez, to do the same job. I'm not sure he has the power to do it. I'm not sure the Iranians would be on board. But there's a kind of not disguised hope that somehow the Syrians could offer a solution to this, at the same time that there's a terrible reluctance to talk to the Syrians. And so the fighting goes on.
You know, in the current edition of Newsweek, you have an article about the ripple effects of this war between Israel and Hezbollah. Let's talk about the ripple effects in Iraq. You write, some of Hezbollah's biggest supporters are our Shiite allies in Iraq. What's their connection between them?
It goes way back. The government in Iraq is dominated by Shia parties that are attached to Shia militias. The president, Nouri al-Maliki, is a longtime member of the Dawa Party. Hezbollah was created in Lebanon in the early 1980s on a foundation that had been laid for the previous decade or more by the Dawa Party, by the Iraqi Dawa Party, which was the first great international Shiite underground terrorist organization. Now, we've created a situation in Iraq where the Dawa Party and a similar group that had split away from it, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, are our two key allies in the government of Iraq. But are there sympathies with Hezbollah when it comes to fighting Israel? Absolutely they are. So the problem that we have is that our best allies are also close friends of our worst enemies in the region at this moment. But it's more complicated and more difficult even than that, because those same militias, particularly the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, have been involved and implicated, along with Muqtada Sadr's party, with these death squads that are now a bigger and bigger problem for the stability of Iraq. Shiite death squads who have taken it in their hands to carry out vigilante justice, not just against Sunni Arab terrorists, but against Sunni Arabs. There's a whole pattern of ethnic cleansing going on in Iraq right now, and it is being carried out by people in police uniforms, very often in police units, and in the Interior Ministry and in the military that the U.S. created, who basically are still members of these radical Shiite militias. So we're depending on the same people in Iraq for stability who are destabilizing the country, and those people are very close to Hezbollah. So it's not a good situation from an American point of view.
And are those militias connected to Iran?
And all of those groups are closely connected to Iran. The Dawa Party, and especially the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, were longtime residents of Iran all through the Saddam Hussein era. They were aided, supported, trained, and armed by Iran in those days. And Iran now has very, very close ties to them. Does that mean that they are completely the puppets of Iran? No. But does that mean that the Iranians know them and understand them and work with them much more effectively than the United States? Yes.
So Iraq and Iran had been real foes. I mean, they fought a long, terrible war in the 80s. But what you're saying is that our invasion of Iraq has brought part of Iraq and Iran together.
Absolutely. Look, the United States supported Saddam Hussein all through the 1980s. And with a vengeance later in that decade, when the United States essentially went to war, at least naval and air war, against Iran. And why did it do that? One of the reasons was that it wanted to avoid the takeover of Iraq by a pro-Shiite, pro-Iran government, by precisely the groups, in fact, that are in power now in Iraq. But once we decided to get rid of Saddam, there really was not another alternative unless Ahmed Shalabi had proved to have a lot more credibility than he did. The Pentagon's idea was to put him in power. But, of course, I've known Ahmed for more than 20 years. He's always been very close to Iran. Why we were surprised later on that he, too, turned out to be on intimate terms with Tehran has always amazed me.
Now, another possible consequence of this war between Israel and Hezbollah, you write that Lebanon could descend into another civil war. What would that mean?
Right now, we're looking at a situation where there are, by UN and other estimates, about 750,000 people who've been displaced out of their homes in southern Lebanon, who've taken the Israelis at their word, who have fled the area. Well, where do they flee to? Lebanon is a country that has suffered from terrible sectarian divisions throughout its history, from before it was a state, even when it was part of the Ottoman Empire. That's a very, very delicate balance there. And when you take 750,000 people who are mostly Shiites and you force them to go live, at least temporarily and maybe for the long term, in areas that are predominantly Druze or Christian or Sunni, when you take people who are mainly from rural backgrounds and you force them to go live essentially as squatters or in tents or in schools temporarily in the urban environment of Beirut, you are hugely destabilizing the country. And in Lebanon, that's particularly problematic because of this sectarian history that exists there. So what you have right now is an environment where the Christians and the Druze and others are accepting these refugees and taking them in and trying to give them food and shelter and help them out. But if this situation continues for any length of time, resentments will grow, and you'll very likely have a situation where people start to fight about trivial matters, and that blows up into something much worse. Added to that is the problem that among the refugees are people who are definitely members of Hezbollah, fighters from Hezbollah, and in some cases they appear to be taking their weapons with them. What happens if the Israelis decide that in order to cripple Hezbollah, they need to go after it where it's hiding or where the refugees are hiding in those Christian and Druze areas? It will create yet more chaos, and it will sow the seeds for potentially for a renewed civil war in Lebanon, which will help, again, to further destabilize a region that is actually currently disastrously fractured in Iraq, in Lebanon, and elsewhere.
What impact do you think this war is having on countries, Arab countries that are American allies?
Not that many Arab countries are American allies, but there are Arab governments that are American allies, and they are finding themselves increasingly and frighteningly isolated. I think the Saudis are the most conspicuous case. The Saudis came out very early and said, Hezbollah has done something wrong here. It has started a war that didn't need to be started, and it should be held to account for this. Well, that was a position that seemed credible in the Arab world and to the Saudis, maybe dangerous, maybe risky, but credible 3 or 4 days into the fighting. But 3 weeks into the fighting, after more than 700 Lebanese have been killed in the Israeli assault, and maybe a third of those are children, that just doesn't seem like a credible position anymore. So the Saudis find themselves more and more isolated, as do the Egyptians, as does King Abdullah in Jordan. And frankly, I think they don't know what to do. They're disgusted by the situation. One Saudi official speaking privately to me at the end of last week when I asked him to comment on the situation said, I'll tell you how I feel personally. I'd like to throw up. This has been a terribly damaging war, not only for the whole Arab world, but for Israel's interests and American interests in the regions over the region over the long term. And the failure to bring it to a rapid conclusion, either by victory or failing that, and that has now been failed, to bring it to an end with a ceasefire is just making the situation incalculably worse.
What are your fears about how this war could spread?
I think the Israelis have made it clear that they don't want this war to spread beyond Lebanon. And they have not attacked Syria, and they have not made any serious noises about attacking Syria in recent weeks. They certainly are not going to attack Iran. And if they did, then they would be asking for still more trouble because there's no follow-up. The most they could do would be to bomb some installations, presumably nuclear installations. But over the long run, those can be – or even over the medium term, those could be rebuilt. And Iran's potential for retaliation is vast. So I think that contrary to the situation in which we found ourselves 3 weeks ago, right at the beginning of this – or a little less than 3 weeks ago, I think that the fears about this war expanding as such in a direct linear way have subsided. But the fears of this war abetting and supporting a growing hatred that fuels the terrorist activity throughout the region and indeed throughout the world, those fears are increasing all the time.
Now, you said you didn't think that this war was going to expand in a linear way, but you think it's going to expand in a nonlinear way?
I absolutely do. If Hezbollah comes under pressure, for instance, let's just talk about Hezbollah. Let's limit it to Hezbollah. Hezbollah is an international terrorist organization. It's not just a political party, and it's not just a guerrilla force. Hezbollah in the past has carried out terrorist operations as far away as Argentina. And they have cost people a lot of lives. There was bombing of the Israeli embassy and of a Jewish community center in Argentina. Hezbollah has many sympathizers in the United States, and not only on ideological grounds. There are court cases pending in the United States against Hezbollah supporters at this very moment. So you could have a situation where Hezbollah came under more and more pressure on the ground in Lebanon and decided to reach out and strike elsewhere, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, maybe 6 months or a year from now. And that has to be a major concern for anyone making policy on this question.
Now, you don't think that Israel intends to bomb any country outside of Lebanon, but what about the United States? There have been reports that behind the scenes, the Bush administration has talked about possibly bombing Iran or Syria. I don't know if you have any inside connections in the Bush administration, but do you think that there are members of the administration who are considering that now?
There have always been members of the Bush administration who have considered that and have talked about it and have leaked about that. Seymour Hersh had an article several months ago that seemed to be leaked intentionally by some people in the administration to sort of float that idea. But it's not a plausible strategy. It's not even a plausible tactic. And the reason is essentially Iraq. The United States has 133,000 very hard-pressed soldiers in Iraq right now. It's taking them out of the far-flung battlefields, moving them into Baghdad, because the capital of the country is the main battleground in Iraq. It's also likely to send 5,000 more troops into Iraq in the near future because the Italians and the Poles and others basically want to get their troops out of the country. They've had enough of this war. So the United States is finding itself more isolated. Instead of drawing down troops, it's increasing its number of troops, and the main battleground is the capital of the country. In a situation like that, the last thing it wants to do is so infuriate and antagonize the neighboring country, the one that has the longest single border with Iraq, the one that sends millions of pilgrims and others into Iraq every year. The last thing the United States wants to do is create a situation of open warfare with that country, which is Iran. And that's why it's not going to do anything.
There are many things I don't understand about what's planned for an endgame of this war, but I guess the main one is, what role does Hezbollah play in an agreement to a ceasefire? Would Hezbollah, do you think, agree to a ceasefire? And they're certainly not going to agree to disarm. And they're the party of God. They think that God is on their side in this. So where do they fit in as negotiators and as agreeing to any kind of long-term agreement?
Hezbollah is the party of God, and it has all the trappings of a religious party, and a lot of its rhetoric is religious. But when it comes to politics, Hassan Nasrallah especially is a very shrewd and calculating politician. And his language and his performance in Lebanon has always been a language that was not wild-eyed religious radicalism. He speaks just like any other politician. There are two members of the cabinet in Lebanon who are members of Hezbollah. What's going on right now is there are negotiations with Hezbollah through the other Shiite party, Nabi Biri's Amal party in Lebanon. And so talks are underway. What would Nasrallah settle for? He's indicated that he would settle for some kind of ceasefire or peace plan similar to the one that has been proposed by Lebanese President Fouad Senyora, which would include the return of Sheba Farms, a little corner of land. Actually, it's disputed between Lebanon and Syria, but the return of that land to Lebanon and out of Israeli hands. Israel has continued to occupy that over the years, and a lot of other seemingly technical issues. And he has said that he wasn't totally against, he hasn't completely opposed the issue of disarming under UN Resolution 1559. But he knows perfectly well that all the other conditions which he demands will be have to be met will not be met, that the Israelis won't agree to them. So he can afford to come across as a pragmatic politician working with Senyora while the Israelis basically say no to Senyora's proposals.
One of the really difficult things about watching this war play out is that on the one hand, it's very possible that this war is an attack on Israel's very being, its very future. At the same time, Israel, in its campaign against Hezbollah, has killed a lot of civilians. And it's just heartbreaking. It's horrible to watch what's the human cost of this war. Now, but does that put your sympathies on Hezbollah? I mean, do you know what I mean? It's like...
Well, it doesn't put my sympathies with Hezbollah, or yours.
No,
but it does put your sympathies with the Lebanese people. And the way the campaign is conducted forces you to sympathize with the Lebanese people if you have any feeling for that culture at all or those people at all. Look, the Israeli line again and again is, we dropped leaflets. We told them to leave. Well, you know, to force 750,000 people out of their homes is a hard thing to do. And leaflets won't do the job. Most people would rather stay where they are if they possibly can. Now they know that men, women, and children who stay where they are very likely to be slaughtered. So more of them will leave if they can. But here's another problem. The roads they leave on are constantly bombed. And people are terrified. So if you're terrified, would you rather go on those roads that you know are terribly dangerous to some place you've never been or can't imagine living, where you don't know what your future will be? Or would you rather stay home and try to tough it out? Well, some people try to tough it out, and a lot of those people are dying.
I guess I'd really like to hear what you think the options are for Israel, knowing what it's up against for Hezbollah, and seeing the cost of the approach that they have taken and how costly that has been in terms of human life. What options do you think Israel has?
I think Israel has to get out of the psychology that one reservist, Israeli reservist we were talking to, described as a gambler psychology. Right now it's in a position where it has to keep doubling its bet or thinking about doubling its bet in terms of the violence in Lebanon. It has to step back from that. It has to look at its own interests and say, is this war working for Israeli interests? And the fact is, it is not. And Israel should support, rather than opposing, a rapid ceasefire. Israel should support the rapid reconstruction of Lebanon. And Israel should support the United States and the international community in pressuring Syria and Iran. But the idea that it can continue to fight this war on Lebanese territory, simply claiming that civilian casualties are the result of cynical ploys by Hezbollah, which they are, is not going to play. I think the United States would do Israel a favor and Israel would do itself a favor if both governments would move quickly for a ceasefire.
Christopher Dickey, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. It's always a pleasure.
Christopher Dickey is Newsweek's Middle East Regional Editor and Paris Bureau Chief. He spoke to us from Paris. Our interview was recorded this morning.